Hi, I'm Rabbi Menachem Wolf of the Spirogro Joseph Chris Center, and I'd like to share with you the Purim story. But before I do, let me take you back 3,300 years, or just over, to when Moses leads the Jewish people out of Egypt. We traveled through the desert for 40 years, and upon Moses' passing, his successor Joshua, Yehoshua, takes us into Israel. The land of Israel is carved up into 12 different states, and a commonwealth is formed, the commonwealth of the Jewish people. For the next 400 years, there is no clear capital within Israel, but with the rise of King David, a capital is established in Jerusalem, and he sets up Temple Mount, Har HaMoriah, as being the place of a future permanent temple. Because from the era of Moses all the way through to David, the capital was wherever the Mishkan was, and the Mishkan, which was the portable temple that we had back from the days of Moses, was very much a temporary structure that could be assembled and disassembled and moved around. And while it didn't move very much once we moved into the land of Israel, it still didn't have all the regality of a permanent structure. King David flattens the Temple Mount in the center of Jerusalem, Har HaMoriah, and he creates the space for where his son Solomon will then go to build the temple. So now we've probably moved on 450 years from the Exodus. King Solomon builds the temple, and it stands for just over 400 years. At which point, Babylon is the world's superpower. Now, Babylon came to power after the Assyrians. And why I just want to mention that is because the Assyrians were the ones that actually exiled 10 of the 12 tribes, some 150 years before the destruction of the first temple, which was done by the Babylonians, the Jewish people were already falling apart as a nation. There were civil wars and internal rebellions, there was a dual monarchy, and I wouldn't say we were the most cohesive nation. So fast forward to the Babylonian era, Nebuchadnezzar and his army march on Jerusalem, and after failing to be able to create any sort of peace deal, he destroys Jerusalem, exiles its inhabitants, and takes the Jews into what's called Babel, the exile of Babylon. Over the next 70 years, we would be spread across from the Mediterranean all the way over to Iran, spread through what would be the Babylonian Empire, and then as Babylon falls to Persia, the Persian Empire. And that's really where we pick up. 70 years after Solomon's temple has been destroyed, approximately 2,500 years ago, the Jewish people living in this now Persian Empire are quite an assimilated mob. We aren't overly engaged with our heritage. While there are more religious factions, there are also assimilated elements of our society, of the Jewish society. And things aren't actually that bad. While we are in exile and away from our religious service of Jerusalem, social life actually is quite impressive. And Jews have been able to find a place within the middle socioeconomic order and have integrated into a society. The king at the time is Ahasuerus, the Persian king. And the Megillah opens up, the Purim story opens up, telling us about him throwing a 180-day party. Not just is this a party, this is debauchery on steroids. Everyone is invited to celebrate, and there are multiple victories that he is celebrating. And the commentaries say he's also celebrating the completion of a 70-year exile of the Jewish people, after which he thought the Jewish people would return to Israel. And now that they haven't, he can see that his reign is intact, and God would not remove him from the throne. And so we find ourselves at this party in the first chapter of the Megillah. It's incredible. It's lavish. And the Jewish people are involved and invited and participate in this party. And we all know that in context of diasporic aspiration, that's pretty much up there. To be invited into the local kingdom's parties and assimilate into their society is something that Jewish people have always found as a medal on their chest. The story kicks off quite quickly with a demand by Ahasuerus wanting his queen, Vashti, to appear naked in front of everyone. some sort of showing off of his prize beauty. And when Vashti refuses, Ahasuerus's advisor, who we come to discover is actually Haman, who is going to be one of the most evil characters in the story, advises him that he's got to kill his wife, Vashti, because this is going to set a precedent of all wives being able to say no to their husbands. He does so, and as he finishes sobering up, some days, weeks later, and he realizes he is now without a royal consort, he's without a queen, he sets up a pageant in order to find a new queen. Esther, we're told that she's the niece of Mordechai. Mordechai is one of the leaders of the Jewish people at the time. And Esther, his niece, is entered into the pageant. She goes with hesitance because it's complicated. She's from an observant home, and to be marrying into the royal family and to marry out of the Jewish culture is something that she has always grown up as being absolutely forbidden. But upon her uncle's recommendation, she does have herself entered into the pageant, which isn't so willing either, because every woman had to register. This is the king's search for a new queen. And the miracle is that she's actually selected from all the women. Ahasuerus takes her as a wife, and Esther becomes Queen Esther. At that point, a party is thrown, the party of Esther. The king has a new wife, the king has a queen, and Esther is elevated to one of the most senior positions within the kingdom. Together with Esther being elevated, her uncle Mordechai is also brought into the royal circle, and Mordechai is some sort of medium-level advisor, definitely an advisor to the queen, and the Megillah shares with us that he hears, because he's now in royal circles and he's got access to certain elements of the palace, he hears a plot by two of the king's guards, and they're plotting to kill the king. Mordechai overhears this, he relays the message, and with that the king is saved, the two guards are killed. And what we're going to find out a little later is that this story is recorded into the royal chronicles. Meanwhile, Haman, the advisor who had given the king the sage advice to kill his queen, Vashti, when she refused to listen, has also made an advancement within his own aspirations, and he has become very much a royal vizier, or a prime minister, if you will. Someone who seems to be able to write legislation, put it in front of the king for rubber stamping. He approaches the king with a plan. Haman has been planning for a long time to kill the Jewish people. And from everything we've been told, he has this unfounded hate for the Jewish people. We know from Haman's ancestry that he actually comes from the tribal origins of Amalek, who are a nation who have been hell-bent on destroying the Jewish people all the way back since Moses and the Jewish people traveling through the desert. And he approaches King Ahasuerus with an idea, but he actually sows the seeds of fear into Ahasuerus, and he says, there is a nation that is unique and different, and they are spread across your empire. This very much is a scary tone. There's this cancerous group of people. And if you think about it, Haman's language is something that has been a part of Jewish history ever since then. This notion that the Jewish people are somehow some sort of parasite that are there to weaken the nation. He puts forward an idea for how Ahasuerus can actually destroy the Jewish people. And he even is willing to put forward his own money to subsidize the method through which the Jewish people will be killed, which is arm the nation, arm the people of Persia, give them weapons, and let them go out and hunt and kill Jews. Not only that, but it will be illegal to be able to sell weapons to Jewish people so that they can't defend themselves. This is a double piece of legislation, and Ahasuerus loves it. In fact, he says, I'll pay for it. This is fine. I totally agree to your idea. You might be thinking, but doesn't he have a Jewish wife? Doesn't he know better? And the answer is no. At this point, Esther has not revealed her own heritage because, at the end of the day, although absorbed into the empire, I don't think that the Jewish people were the most loved members of society. Now, Mordechai, being within the royal circle and being around the palace, does get wind of Haman's plan. And he informs Esther of this vicious plan to kill the Jewish people. You see, being a royal doesn't mean that Esther actually knows what's happening in the empire. In fact, I would say, based on those times, being a queen definitely kept her out of the loop. She has no royal ancestry of her own. She's not blue-blooded. She's not a connected person. And therefore, she definitely does not know what's happening in Ahasuerus's land. So Mordechai informs her and says, "You are the only one who can approach the king. You are the only one who can beg him to change his mind about killing the Jewish people." Esther's petrified. "How am I meant to save the Jewish people? I haven't even been with Ahasuerus for months." And "been," she means in the most intimate way. It seems that although she's the queen of Persia, she too is on the outer. There are other women in Ahasuerus's harem, and therefore she doesn't hold that much power. Mordechai explains to her that this may be the whole reason why she has even become the queen of Persia, and says, "You've got to approach the king." And so Esther says, "I'll do so, but you've got to back me up. I've got to have spiritual momentum. Have the Jewish people pray for me. Have them join me. Have them pray for me. Have them create a spiritual momentum so that I will be successful in my approach to Ahasuerus." Mordechai gathers the Jewish people, particularly the children, for days of fasting, study, and prayer. It's remarkable because these are the people who had been assimilated some while back and were quite happy to participate in Ahasuerus's party, which had been so much more than a party and political participation. This has been a party of debauchery. And now here they were, gathered with Mordechai, praying, fasting, studying. This had been a wake-up call, an existential question of who are we and why don't we want to be killed? What is it that we are here to achieve? And with Haman's declaration of murder, the Jewish people came to realize that they are not here to just participate within a society, but there's a contribution, a particular contribution that the Jew makes. And they had fallen away from that. They'd got lost in the materialism and the comfort of their lives. And they experienced regret. And they experienced something that would elicit a heavenly blessing that would alter their destiny. Esther approaches the king after days of fasting, petrified. Because if she approaches the king without permission, if she puts forward a demand without being offered the opportunity, she could be seen as committing an act of insubordination, standing up to the king. She could easily be killed, just as her predecessor Vashti was. And the miracle is that she does approach Ahasuerus, and we're told that Ahasuerus was most embarrassed and furious that he'd been approached by his queen without being announced, that she's putting pressure on him. And yet, in that moment, he calms himself, and he asks her, "What is it that you want?" At this point, Esther does not betray her true intention. And she says, "I would like to invite the king, and I would like to invite the king's prime minister, Haman, to a small party that I would like to throw in your honor." Ahasuerus agrees, and a date is set for the first banquet. Ahasuerus and Haman come to the banquet. And Esther flatters Ahasuerus in front of a small group of people. She treats him like a king. And Ahasuerus is so warm and inspired in the moment that he asks Esther, "What is it that I can give you? How can I show my love to you? Let me give you half my empire." And Esther bides her time. And she says, "My love, What I'd really like is for you to come back for another party. I'd like to really show my gratitude and my appreciation to you." And she plans a second party, to which Ahasuerus agrees, and of course, Haman can't be more chuffed. Here he is, privately dining with the king and the queen, and all she wants is for him to be more in her presence. And with that, Esther has laid a trap for how she's going to expose Haman for being the tyrant and the murderer that he truly is. One night, Ahasuerus is in bed, and he can't fall asleep. It's not like him to stay up at night without falling asleep, and he's troubled. And so he calls for someone to read to him, someone to entertain him. And the particular entertainment that is called for on this particular night is that the Book of Chronicles should be read. And so the stories of his majestic victories is read to him. And then a particular story is read. It's the story of Mordechai saving the king. At the end of the story, the king says, "This man saved my life. There was a plot to assassinate me. Share with me, what was the reward? What reward did we give this Jew Mordechai?" And the chronicle reader shares that there was no reward. This is an unfinished story. By pure happenstance, at that point, Haman is coming to speak with the king. This time, and as a matter of urgency in the middle of the night, because he is sick and tired of Mordechai. And in this moment of, dopamine rush, he feels that midnight is the perfect time to approach the king with a request to kill Mordechai. He'd been spending the whole day ruminating and spending time with his family and personal advisors about how to deal with Mordechai, the insolent Jew who refused to bow, who refused to pay any respect to Haman. How could this Jew refuse to give Haman the respect that he deserved just because of the high office that he held? This is a Jew from the nation that he couldn't wait to kill, but it was a matter of urgency that he killed Mordechai, the Jewish leader. And tonight he was approaching the king with a plan to hang Mordechai on a public gallows that he had constructed. He asks for an urgent audience, and an audience is granted, middle of the night. And Ahasuerus says, "Haman, I know you have come to speak to me about something, but I'd like to speak to you about something that's weighing on my mind." And he asks, "What should be done to a man whom the king wishes to honor?" He doesn't let on that he's talking about Mordechai. And so Haman presumes that there is only one person whom the king could wish to honor at this stage of Persian history, and that would be himself, Haman. And he says, "My king, I would suggest that you take the royal horse and place the person whom you wish to honor on top of the horse, dress him in royal finery, and have somebody," and Haman obviously thinks Mordechai, "lead the horse, yelling in front, 'This shall be done to the man whom the king wishes to honor.'" The king says, "This is so appropriate. This is a brilliant idea, Haman," and instructs him to immediately find Mordechai and actually do this to Mordechai. And so we're told that he takes Mordechai and he puts him on the horse, and he dresses him in royal finery and leads him through the capital of Persia. Commentaries tell us that when Haman's daughter saw someone being led in royal finery, in the most beautiful garments, on a royal horse, and that someone else was leading that person, Haman's daughter just presumed it was her father on the horse and took the opportunity to tip out the family waist from a balcony position onto whomever was leading the horse, presuming that it was Mordechai. Later that day, she finds out that in fact she'd just poured the family waist on her own father's head, embarrassing him in public. And in a state of absolute shame, she jumps from the very balcony and kills herself. Suffice to say, this is a tragic day in Haman's home. He has been humiliated in public for having to lead Mordechai. He's been humiliated in public being poured, having household waste poured on him, and he has lost a daughter all on the same day. While he's grieving later in that day, while he is having to handle everything that he's gone through, royal guards approach his home to rush him because he has been invited to another festive meal with Esther, and he's now running late. And so he's rushed to the party of Esther. At this party, like at the first, the king asks Esther, "What can I give you, my dear? What is it that I can give the woman that I love? I'm willing to give you up to half my empire." It's at this point that Esther breaks down and says, "My lord, I want you to know that I'm from a slave nation. I'm from the Jewish people. I want you to know that I'm a Jewess. And I want you to know that you have passed legislation to destroy my people. I don't want anything but life, both for myself and my people." It seems that Ahasuerus wasn't particularly familiar with this and asks for a bit more explanation and says, who has passed such legislation? Who is responsible for wanting to kill your people?" And she points at Haman and says, "This evil man, Haman, he is the one who has had you rubber stamp this legislation." Ahasuerus is fuming. Now he's been stood up. Now he's been embarrassed. Now he is sitting at a royal table and he is coming to realize that he is going to have to kill his wife because of his prime minister's legislation. Not only that, this is the second wife that he has to kill on Haman's advice. And while he goes out to cool himself and to collect himself and work out what his next step is, the Megillah says that Haman jumps onto the daybed that Esther is actually lying on during this meal, begging for forgiveness, asking her to spare him. Ahasuerus returns into the room and sees Haman on the daybed with his wife. And without asking for an explanation for context, he says, "While I am in the house, do you dare to sleep with my wife?" And with that, Haman's fate is sealed. What will the punishment be? Well, some advisor who happens to be there at the time, and we're told is actually a Jewish person, he advises the king, "Perhaps, why don't you hang Haman on the very gallows that he had prepared for the man who saved your life, Mordechai?" Immediately, a decree is put out that Haman needs to be hanged, and he is killed, together with his family. And further legislation is passed upon Esther's request. "Please, if you're not going to cancel your original legislation to kill the Jewish people, at least give the Jewish people the right to defend themselves." And it's important that we understand that, because over the next few days, when the date of actually massacring Jews arrives, the Jews have been given permission to defend themselves, and defend themselves they do. When the day arrived for Jewish people to be massacred, the Jewish people defended themselves. There were attacks, but they were able to fend them off and kill their attackers. At the end of what is a very short battle, order returns to Persia. And King Ahasuerus approaches Esther and Mordechai and says, "In compensation for all that has been done to your people, I'm going to grant you both a special role of governance in the nation." And Mordechai and Esther elevated not only in their positions within the palace, but to have an authority over the governance of the people, ensuring a greater measure of protection for their own people, the Jewish people. Since then, the Jewish people have been celebrating this day of Purim. It is the story of a heroine named Esther. We eat foods, we give charity, and we celebrate, and we read the story of Esther. And that is the story of Purim.